Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong, profitable impact on your business.
Good morning and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I am truly honored to share the microphone with the most interesting people. Now, these are people who are business leaders. They may be authors, speakers. They can be titans in whatever industry that we're going to be talking about, but they have wonderful stories to share, and they're here to freely share their journeys, their business wisdom, their tips, and actionable advice. In short, they are willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And in fact, my guests are so compelling and so insightful that this podcast was cited on Inc.com as one of the best business podcasts you need to be listening to, and has been mentioned on Entrepreneur and MSNBC. Today, Nathan Shuloff, the father of the MP3 player, joins me to discuss lessons in business and life. And here's the thing, his stories are so fascinating. We had a great pre-interview chat. His stories are so terrific that I asked him to join me for two back-to-back interviews, and this one is part one. So just a bit about Nathan. The MP3 audio file transformed the way we access music online, obviously. Nathan is a visionary innovator who is changing people and cultures around the world. Among other things, he invented, patented, and introduced the first MP3 player, as I mentioned, and is widely regarded as the father of the MP3 industry and is one of the leading entrepreneurs of the internet age. He has been a regular guest on such television shows as Good Morning America, Entertainment Tonight, Your World with Neil Cavuto, and CNBC's Squawk Box, as well as many others. He speaks several times per month at professional events related to high technology, business innovation, and the music industry, both in the United States and around the world. Nathan, good morning. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. I have been looking forward to this chat for weeks. Thank you so much for coming.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me. You know, I have also. I enjoy this very much.
Oh, good. And, you know, when I asked you, we had our pre-interview. I do this with every guest. And I couldn't take notes quickly enough. I really couldn't. So I remember saying, do you mind doing back-to-back? And you said, yes. You didn't even have to think about it. So here we go. So listen, before we get too into what we're going to be talking about, tell people about you, where they should go look for you, what your kind of life experience has been, and, you know, anything that I might have missed in the intro.
Well, people expect me to be very technical. And over the years, I have learned to be somewhat technical, but more from 5,000 feet. I've always considered myself a guy that just loves gadgets. I've always loved new, exciting, especially technology gadgets. And I've always been able to have a vision of where these gadgets are going. Back in the 80s, I just got the feeling memory, storage, and speed over the years is going to take us to some very exciting places, and which it did.
Nathan, I lost you there. Can you hear me? Yeah, I lost
yes,
you. I don't know what happened there.
Okay.
You may have to repeat a bit of it because you just cut completely out.
Sure,
and for our audience,
so you know,
Nathan is in Mexico. The reception there is not what we would expect here in the United States, so just kind of bear with us. If we cuts out or kind of goes away, just hang in there. We haven't quit.
Thank you. You know, I've always said that I'm really not a technical guy. I have learned to be technical. I'm a gadget guy. I've always had the vision of where gadgets are going. And back in the 80s, when I first discovered personal computers. I knew that memory, storage, and processing speed were going to take gadgets to a new level in the future, which is truly only beginning.
Okay, there you went again. Can you hear me?
Yes, is this better?
Yeah, a little bit. Okay, so we caught that second part, and we may just have a few technical difficulties, which on the face of it is ironic because you're a techie guy, I'm a techie guy, you know, girl rather, and technology may or may not be our friend today, but we're going to power through this or reschedule if we have to, but let's keep on going.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. I do a lot of keynotes at very large technical conferences. The largest campus party, which has 25,000 attendees. And I've always noticed at these technical conferences, they have the worst internet of anywhere I've gone. And I always say the same thing. Hey, here's all these technical people.
Yeah, what happened? And that's just the way it is. Look, I think I told you this when we chatted before. It used to be when I was younger, if my car broke down, the world ended. I mean, it just ended. Now, if my internet's not working, it's the equivalent. I mean, I can sit in my car, waiting for a tow truck driver for hours because I've got my phone to entertain me. I can look at the flowers, the fields, doesn't bother me anymore. If my internet is not working properly, I am stomping all over the house. So it's funny how our lives and our attitudes kind of change over time.
It is that as a technical person, when I think about it, it's a little bit scary. Especially where I see the future with artificial intelligence going. Is it too much of our lives? You know, this is really a big issue facing, I think, our society today.
It does seem to be everywhere, doesn't it? I mean, I've gotten to the point where I can tell if I go to, let's just say, my Sears account and I have a question, I can tell when I'm speaking to a bot in the chat. And I instantly say, I would like a live person. I don't want to talk with you. You're wasting my time. They're everywhere, absolutely everywhere.
Well, I think there's going to be an emergence, and this is not only my opinion, of artificial intelligence over the next 10 years. Up till now, computers have taken jobs. They've done functions that humans have done. But there's always been a saying that, well, there's still things that humans do better. Well, that's becoming less and less, and soon that will go away. Processing speed, memory is becoming phenomenal, and the thinking time of machines and the ability to think like humans is not only amazing today, especially with image searches and research that's currently going on. Some of the things I've seen in a technology called quantum entanglement, which was originally a theory by Albert Einstein and Tesla in 1938, is doing some amazing things in research right now, just with energy in the mind.
Can you give us some kind of case studies? I mean, I'm not entirely sure I understand what you're talking about.
Sure.
Or examples?
In 1938, Einstein came up with a theory called quantum entanglement and said, you know, when you break down particles and physics breaks it down to lower levels, smaller levels, every time they find there's a smaller level. So Einstein had a theory that when you get down to such a level, really everything looks the same. And as Einstein said, everything is energy. Well, he felt that he had a theory that you could actually move things just with your mind by moving protons and down to a nano level. Well, there's a company that I've been working with or involved with as an advisor since 2006 that has developed a hand for individuals that have lost their own hand or arm. And by mentally thinking of opening or closing, you can actually use this prosthesis. I have this on video, which there are no wires. It's a thought process, and the more you use it, the better you become. And it's in the 90% success rate at this point. Now, this technology...
Now, isn't that how Stephen isn't that how he communicated with his onboard computer, was by thought?
Somewhat, in his later stages, yes. Yes, yes.
Okay. So I have a little
there's
bit
a lot of...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, anybody that wants to learn more about this, if you Google quantum entanglement, I think you'll find it pretty exciting. But, you know, I think there's a feeling that at times technology has become so great. There are some people that think, well, there's nothing left. We've reached the level. From where my vision is, that will never happen. Times ahead of us will be just as exciting as times in the past.
What are you predicting?
It's the same thing. The more processing speed, look where we came from. I was looking at something today. I manufactured hard disk drives in 1989. The state-of-the-art 10-megabyte hard drive in 1989 for an IBM or an Apple was $4,000. 10 megabytes. That was 1989 for a 10-megabyte hard drive was $4,000. Today, you can get gigabytes on a little USB drive for $10, $20. Look what technology has come. We can't be so naive to think that it's going to stop here. I see great strides, especially in artificial intelligence, driverless cars. This all stems from faster processing speeds and smaller amounts of storage for larger amounts of data.
It's almost scary. It really is. Driverless cars just make me go, ooh, I'm not getting in one of those. Maybe it's a control thing, but I just don't have any interest in putting my body into a car that doesn't have a driver.
It would scare me a little bit, too. But when you think about it, a computer can think faster and quicker than
right.
me, especially as time to come. This technology is still in its infancy.
Yeah, and I've been kind of watching Tesla, and he's melting down a bit, it seems like. But you know, what sticks in my mind, and I suspect most people's minds, are the racks, you know, when the things go really bad. They're not really looking at the things that work all the time. They're looking at the spectacular failures, which as humans, we kind of tend to do that.
I've been very, very fortunate because I got to see all this. I first entered this industry in 1980. I heard of a little company that no one ever heard of before that was building these personal computers. This company was called Apple Computer. And they were actually building 10,000 machines a month, which was a lot back then. We had a small installed base. So I built the first word processor. One of the first word processors that became a best-selling Apple word processor in 1980. And that actually was my start into this industry. Like I said, I was not a technical person. It wasn't something that I was interested in all my life. I saw a vision of this industry was going somewhere, and I wanted to be a part of it. So I've learned to be technical. I learned to speak engineer.
So, Nathan, are you essentially at your heart an inventor, that you can kind of see the big picture and then work your way backwards from that?
I'm an inventor and I'm a promoter. I've always taken my idea and then my own CEO hired the first person and designed our marketing plan. So I'm basically a creative salesperson with one hell of an imagination.
What I was trying to get at. You've got this huge imagination, and then you just go after it.
Oh, I always say an entrepreneur is someone that jumps off a cliff and builds an airplane on the way down. The number one question I always get is, how do you think of the MP3 player? And that really led me to the company before the MP3 player, which was called Test Drive. You probably never heard of it, but many of us still use the technology today. This was a technology I found and purchased in 1992. What it does was an encryption technology, and CD-ROMs were just becoming popular on computers back in those days. They cost $1,000, and they were external devices to hook up to your computer. You know, but I had this vision back then that someday these CD-ROMs were going to be built into every computer. This is what I had to convince venture capitalists at that time to fund my company in 1992, because CD-ROMs were not in computers. But realized back up until then, people were using floppy disks, which only held 1.2 megabytes of data. That's like a picture. So here you have CDs which held 540 megabytes of data, which was amazing. So, you know, it wasn't a brilliant vision to actually see this jump. It was very clear. So I found this technology that encrypted software, and you could unlock it or lock it remotely. So what we did is we went to Microsoft, Lotus at the time, all the large companies, and got them to put their software on our encrypted CDs. And users could try this 5 or 6 times. And we had $50,000 worth of software on one CD. And they could try it several times. Then it would lock up. And if they wanted to purchase it, call our number, and we could give them an encrypted number over the phone, which generated differently every time for safety purposes. And they could actually purchase the software. Well, boom, it became an instant success. At the time, we were the first ones to actually bundle CDs in a magazine. We did that with PC World at the time to get our distribution out there. Well, the company, within 14 months, was sold to a large conglomerate called R.R. Donnelley & Sons, who used the technology for many different things. And I thought, well, what do I do next? I thought, well, you know, if we can do this with software, we should be able to do with music. I thought, you know, back then, to get one song, you had to buy what was called a whole album. You had to buy $20 or $15 worth of songs. I thought we should be able to put it in any order. I could also see the vision of where computers were going. The internet didn't become popular until starting about 1995, and this was 94. And boom, I hired a group of engineers. I said, tell me how we can do this, and devised a plan that eventually evolved, changed, and in 1997, we launched the MP3 player called the Listen Up Player.
And, you know, I remember all of these things. My first computer, honestly, was a $3,000 boat anchor. It had MS-DOS. I still have one of the binders somewhere in my office closet, but I wanted that computer, and this was obviously, internet. I mean, we really didn't have internet as we understand it now. And even in the last 10 years, internet has just remarkably changed, you know, how we can create pictures and graphics and, you know, music downloads and everything that we're talking about. None of this has happened. It's almost been a blink of an eye. It's happened so, so, so quickly. It hasn't taken decades, years, you know, centuries. It's just going so, so fast. And when you're talking about all these different technologies, I've owned every one of them. I mean, I was an early adapter for all of it. So just hearing you tell this story is, you know, I'm having flashbacks almost, like, oh my gosh. But, you know, those of us who have been kind of playing around with computers or the internet or building our lives basically on the internet, we get this. We totally understand what you're talking about.
Well,
so, I mean, you had these mass... I'm sorry, keep going.
Yeah, go ahead. I said you jogged my memory with the word boat anchor, which was a common term back then. But do you remember, and you may not be old enough to remember, of where the actual laptop came from, where it started? And
I don't have any idea. I can't wait to hear it.
Well, you've probably seen books from a book company called Osborne Books. Well, that was eventually started and sold to McGraw-Hill by a man named Adam Osborne, who was an old friend of mine who's not with us anymore. And Adam started a computer company in the mid or late 80s, and it was called Osborne Computers. 60 Minutes did a big segment on it. They became hugely successful overnight. And Adam built the first, what he called, portable computer. In the technology industry, it was termed luggable because it weighed about 20 pounds and it folded up and it was cute. And it became very, very popular and hugely successful overnight. And that was actually the first step for the laptop. You know, it was a small step. But it was the first idea of actually making computer technology portable. After a few years, Adam made a huge business mistake, which killed his company. Like every entrepreneur, we get more excited about what we're doing and how neat it is than sometimes business decisions. And he announced his upcoming computer and how much better it was. Well, he still had a huge inventory of the old computer, which killed his sales and eventually killed his company. But it's something to Google, and it's some interesting information and some good pictures.
No, I'll definitely look at that. I got my first laptop in 2000, I believe, which is only 18 years ago now. And looking back at that thing, it was a brick. It was, you know, kind of short and wide and heavy and really didn't have much processing speed, but I loved that thing. I think it was a Dell, and it was expensive. And I played on that thing until I wore the keyboard out. I kid you not. But, I mean, it really was a brick compared to what we're, you know, talking about now, iPads, iPhones, Androids. I mean, it's just amazing how far we've come in just 18, 19, 20 years. For me, anyway, that's when I really started paying attention.
Yes, yes, it is amazing. And I still get excited about it. These days I do a lot of keynotes. I enjoy them. And I do a lot of technology conferences. And I love working with the youth today because I so see them as our future. And they energize me.
Oh, I can imagine. I'm reading your book, and thank you for sending that to me, by the way. You said in the very beginning of the book that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, along with you, were at the forefront of the technology boom and helped each other sometimes unwillingly. What does that mean?
Well, a lot of times, for instance, my first entree into the computer industry, I rode Apple's success. When I heard Apple was putting out those 10,000 machines a month, I decided, well, I'm going to build something that most of the people want when they buy one of these machines. And back then, I could say a word processor to 90% of the people, and they had no idea what a word processor was unless you were a lawyer. They really weren't out in the public. Back then, we used something called typewriters. So I knew by me building a word processor, I might be able to change the world a bit. So Apple really gave me that opportunity. Another opportunity I had through Apple was, did anyone who had an early Apple II computer knew that it only gave you 48 columns across the screen? Well, on a written letter, you really need 64 columns, not 48, to make it like a standard letter. And the original Apples opened up and you could stick other cards in them. Well, with Apple's permission, I made what was called an AdRAM, which was an extra memory card that went in the Apple that brought the 48K up to 64, which Apple eventually distributed. So that was an opportunity for me. When I did test drive, I can remember sitting in Microsoft's office, actually, and it was very important to get Microsoft on that CD, and it was a very important meeting, and which Microsoft eventually did, and that opened many doors for me. When I did Audio Highway, which was the MP3 company, we became content providers and supplied Microsoft with content, and they supplied us with content. So I find other people's success in the industry offer other people opportunities in the industry. You can either be afraid of them or you can take the opportunities.
Exactly. And I think that's a brilliant strategy. I wanted to ask you about Information Highway. That's something that you did, and I think that's what you were just talking about, where you download information onto a portable device and then play it back at will. Part of the book that had me just going, oh my gosh, it says it paid off when you took the company public and made millions on day one, and then you sponsored an all-day concert at Dodger Stadium that actually was the first live concert being simulcast online. I would love for you to chat about that.
Yes, that's on my YouTube channel, actually. You can see it. Or on my website, NathanShawoff.com, under the video section. And what we did, we had just gone public, and life was difficult up till then, raising money. And all of a sudden, we had just many, many millions of dollars in the bank, and we could actually execute our plan. So Clear Channel came to us to co-produce one of the largest concerts in the country called Wango Tango in Los Angeles, California. It still exists today. And we had the largest crowd ever in Dodger Stadium, which was 80,000 people, and broadcast to over 2 million, which doesn't sound like that today that much. Back then, it was phone lines. You had little squares on the screen. We had an all-day concert with Britney Spears, Will Smith, Ricky Martin, many others. And we did interviews. It was not only fun, it was a first. We weren't sure how it was going to come out. Again, back then, bandwidth was very, very scarce. T1s were $10,000 a month, where today they're like $200 a month. Those are high-speed phone lines, T1s, for those who...
I had one at one time, and I seriously, it was more than my mortgage. Seriously.
I understand. Not only was it $10,000 a month, when we had it installed in 1994, they were very, very new and only corporations were getting them. We had to spend over $100,000, which we had to pay for. They dug up our parking lot to put in the wiring and everything. So it was $10,000 a month plus over $100,000 installation fee. Which are peanuts today. So if technology does change, it does get cheaper. And Wango Tango changed our life. Yes, Audio Highway started out being called Information Highway Media Technology. And it was a work in progress name for a research company working on the MP3 player. Then when we brought it out, we changed it to Audio Highway in New England Public, our underwriter, Chet Paulson, a wonderful human being, said, you know, with this internet craze, we need a .com name, and we want to change it to audiohighway.com. And since Chet had all the money he was going to give it to us, I was in agreement.
So, I mean, you just raised an interesting point for me, at least. As a web developer, people always say, oh, can I get a .net or a .business or a and I always say, get a .com. We're trained from infancy practically to go look for a .com, unless, of course, you're a .org, you know, you're an organization. But what are your thoughts on that? I mean, there are so many different extensions, and I frankly ignore every one of them. I want a .com.
I do, too. But that's just my feeling at me because I'm an older person. And I've been in the industry so long, and I'm used to a .com. I find the biggest mistakes entrepreneurs make, and I talk about this in my book, is valuation. I find too many entrepreneurs starting out valuation more than they value execution money. I've seen so many companies who think they're valued so high and they don't take the money when they should take the money. I have a theory that's led to some of my successes, and that is always take the money. I'm a big believer in that, unless it's such a bad deal. But I can remember so many companies that have had opportunities to take the money. And realize when you're in your startup phase, if you don't execute and you don't make it happen, your company is worth zero. But if that money can allow you to execute and you can be the success you think they are, the difference in the valuation and how much you're going to get is meaningless. It's the end result that's important. And I think too many young entrepreneurs can't separate their ego from the end result. Have you run into that at all?
Well, I think a lot of it is they simply don't want to lose control. And, you know, by bringing in other money, you do lose some control. But what do you advise people do when they have that kind of mindset?
Well, there are trade-offs in taking the money. No one gives you money for nothing. But I think control somewhat is overrated. I found from the time I went public, my company was a very different company. But, you know, I used to spend a lot of my time in running a company in something I call kid shit. And I meant politics within the company as ego-driven, of this person being jealous of this person, or that person being jealous over that person. And my conclusion was, if you're good at what you do, you will never be replaced. Focus on being good at what you do. And I find that's the same thing with control. I had a very serious board of directors made up of well-known CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. And there was never a time that I can think of that they really didn't give me their full support and their votes at board meetings. Now, when we were in public and I had this board, I had given up a lot of control. They were my boss. But on the other hand, if you're doing a good job, they don't want to lose you. And they want to keep you motivated. It's a two-way street. So I was really never afraid of being replaced. I was never afraid of giving up control.
Well, and from listening to you and reading your book, I think you have a pretty clear mandate that if one thing doesn't work out, you go somewhere else and do something else. So you seem to have led a pretty fearless life.
That's good and bad.
I know.
The world is full of opportunities. Yeah, sure, there's a lot of trade-offs. You know, I would have liked to have been a little closer with my family than I have been. In my book, I get into some of my personal things, and you know, I describe it as very much a successful, dysfunctional life. A dysfunctional life filled with successes. But there are trade-offs. You know, those trade-offs, I probably would make the same decisions again in many cases. I've had a wonderful life. I still do. I like what I do. I feel so bad for people that look forward to Fridays, because all my life I look forward to Mondays.
And see, I don't recognize Monday as being a good day or Friday being let's go. To me, every day is a work day. Even if I'm not in here at my desk, I'm thinking, I'm plotting, I'm planning, I'm woohooing. Yeah, good idea, Denise. I mean, I'm always in that mode. So Monday and Friday mean nothing to me, honestly. But I think a lot of entrepreneurs, solopreneurs actually feel that way. We're always in our head. We're always thinking. We're always plotting. We're always planning. We're always high-fiving ourselves or going, oh, crap. Let's fix that one. But we're always just kind of there. Don't you find that?
Oh, yes. You know, I, like you, I like to work, so weekends are all the same. But when I ran companies, employees take off on the weekends. And I also have only slept 3 or 4 hours a night all my life. And I'm comfortable.
You and me both.
So when I'd be up working, you know, everybody else would be sleeping. And people would always comment how that my emails would come at 3, 4, 5 in the morning. People had difficulty keeping up with me because I would work 2 and 3 shifts straight.
But it's not really working. I mean, sometimes, obviously,
really
we're going to come across a task that just kicks us in the butt. It happens to me, and I'm a nerd like you can't believe. But every once in a while, something will just kind of reach around and bite me right in the back of the neck. Okay, so I have to walk off. But you just said something important. When email really kind of came into prevalence, which, you know, I've been working at this for a long time, I was like, oh, I can connect with people at 3 in the morning. And I would always have to preface this with, look, I don't expect an answer right away. I'm just awake. I don't expect you to be. And I would have to just kind of almost quasi-apologize for doing my business at 3 and 4 and 5 in the morning, because people would say, oh, my God, you know, I need to jump on this right away. No, you really don't. I just had a thought and I wanted to share it while it was still, you know, at the forefront of my mind. Now, you know, people know me well enough, and we all do it, that it's not necessary to kind of explain why you're awake at some ungodly hour in the morning. So, yeah, that was kind of an eye-opener for me. I was like, ooh, I can do business at 3 in the morning. Woohoo! And I loved it.
Are you involved with energy at all? What are your thoughts on energy?
Physical energy or mental energy, emotional energy? What are we talking
about?
Have
you seen my company, Solar Components? Have you gotten to that?
No, I haven't gotten there. No.
Okay.
And my sister
lives
in California, and she went full solar, and her utility bill went from hundreds of dollars a month to last month. She said she was a little bit miffed because it got to $11. It went from $9 to $11.
Yeah, it's not only saving money, it's leaving a smaller footprint in our world. I think just by using solar and, you know, knowing that you're naturally generating your own energy gives you a good feeling, you know. And do you
now, this
people
is a
don't
new
realize
company,
it?
Nathan?
No, it's old.
No.
Well, I started it in about 2008, and it won the Innovation Award at the Consumer Electronics Show. It really made some differences in the solar world for charging devices. You know, I got interested in this from all my trips to India and learning about solar and energy. And do you know that the sun puts enough energy on our planet every single day to run the entire planet for 1 year? We just have to get better at harvesting it.
Now, I don't know anything about solar, but I have read that there are some places in the world that are, you know, chronically foggy or overcast or just don't get sufficient sun to power solar panels. Is that correct, or is that old news, or has it been debunked?
No, that is correct. There's a lot of things that make solar work. One of the main things is governments give subsidies that if you use solar, they will give you tax breaks. And that's what really makes it cost effective, because after the equipment and maintenance cost, you have to really analyze it. That like Hawaii and Germany are some of the biggest incentive payers in solar. Germany is the number one country in the world supporting solar, and parts of U.S. Believe it or not, New Jersey is a big subsidy area. But some of the subsidies are starting to be cut, and they're becoming less and less. But leaving a smaller footprint and knowing that you're generating your old energy, your own energy, and the cost of solar equipment has come substantially down to where it possibly does make sense for you today.
Now, what is the name of the company so people can go find it?
Oh, Solar Components. And what they do is they make a device that will charge your iPhone. It'll charge a couple iPhones a day just from the sun. But there's a lot of them on the market, and many of them work very, very well. Another good company that makes one is called Zero Gravity. They make some very nice solar devices, and I have nothing to do with them.
I'll have to check that out. So you have a far-ranging inventive mind, clearly. So let's go back just a bit, because I was reading in your, I guess this is an autobiography, that you had your first checking account when you were about 6 years old. So business and, you know, really kind of stepping up into your business power, I guess we would call it, was kind of ingrained in you at a very young age. Tell that story if you don't mind, because it's a beaut.
When I found the money, is it that story?
Yeah. I was reading that and smiled.
I was about 6 years old with my parents, and I was walking down the street, and I found a wallet with hundreds of dollars in it. My parents said, well, we have to take it to the police station. Back in those days, that's what you did. You took it to the police station. The police said, well, we'll advertise it, and we'll look for it, and if no one claims it in 30 days, you can have the money. It's yours. So in 30 days, no one claimed it, and I actually did get the money, and that was my first bank account. My parents opened it, and it remained all the way to I was an adult using it. I did the same thing, actually, for my son, Jordan, who still uses the same bank account from when he was 6 years old.
And, see, that's something that I think a lot of people don't think to do is teach money management and money responsibility from a very young age. And I think in many ways that's where our schools definitely fail our youth, and parents do as well. You know, they're just not saying, look, this is a real world. You're going to be entering it at some point. Let's give you some baselines here. Let's talk about money. Let's talk about capital. Let's talk about savings. Let's talk about responsible spending. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to really happen much, and I think that's sad.
Well, I think that came with being an entrepreneur. And I think somewhat you're born with that. I think an entrepreneur is basically a salesperson with passion. And if I had to evaluate the number one attribute that really drives me, it's passion. No matter what I do, I get excited about it. If I don't get excited about it, I don't do it. You know, I got to tell you, my first job in the 70s was I drove a taxi cab in San Francisco. I was in law school, and it was something I could do and study my law books while I was waiting for a fare. And you know, I loved that job. I had passion. I would pick up people And they would ask me questions about San Francisco. I could show them what I loved about San Francisco. Now, to someone else, it may have been, well, you were driving a cab, whether I was driving a bus, whether I had passion for what I was doing. You know, in my book, I talk about a job I had selling insurance, which I had no passion for. Eventually, I could no longer do it anymore, because if you don't have passion, you're wasting your time and you're wasting your soul.
I absolutely agree. Before we got on today, I was listening to Earl Nightingale, and he was talking about this 30-day challenge, and he was talking about you have to have passion. You have to be able to see, and I'm paraphrasing, you have to really be able to see your vision and then step into it and then live it. And I agree wholeheartedly. You can't just put on a piece of paper, okay, I'm going to make $250,000 next month, and oh, by the way, that's going to be net. You have to actually step into that and live it and breathe it. And eventually, you know, as you take all the steps to make that happen, it does happen. But you can't just go, oh, wow, I'm going to do that. Maybe one day, kind of, sort of. I mean, it's just you have to be excited and passionate and active. You can't just think it and think it's going to show up. You have to actually take those steps. And I think that's where a lot of people maybe miss the boat. They're like, oh, I can do this. I can do this. Law of attraction. But they're not. There's no activity. Am I right? Am I wrong?
Yep.
What do you think?
Totally right. You know, I can remember raising money and all, you know, talk about it. People say, oh, I'm in. I want to do that till it comes time to write the check. And those are the people who actually execute. I remember when I was raising my son, I was a single poor parent. And my son, Jordan, was a handful growing up. And I used to get calls from the school on a weekly basis. And I remember one day a science teacher called me. And I said, okay, what did Jordan do now? He said, well, he said, I was doing an experiment with dry ice. And I told all the students, whatever you do, don't touch the dry ice. He said, Jordan touched the dry ice. I said, well, you know, if you'd tell me not to touch the dry ice, I would have touched it too. So, you know, I think what type of person are you? You know, an entrepreneur is someone who likes to go to the unknown. So when you hear, I can't, yes, you can. I've always believed that there's nothing that a human being can't do. We just haven't found out how yet. But, you know, if I had told you on a little cell phone 20 years ago, every answer to the world is in this little phone. And if I just told you about Google, you would have never believed me.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't be so naive to underestimate the future or the powers of our imagination and the powers of reality.
Listen, I agree with you. I find in my life, and I find by speaking with people like you, have created these enormous companies and opportunities and businesses and tried and failed and gone back and said, okay, I'm going to do something different. The minute you give up is the minute you're kind of done. But if we never give up and we always think, you know, there's something better, it's that next step, it's that next action, it's that next thought that comes into my head. And Nathan, I firmly believe in my intuition. My intuition is my friend, let me tell you. And if a nugget pops into my head, I take action. I don't argue. I don't wander off and go, oh, that's interesting, let me put it on my to-do list. And you're going to think I'm nuts, but there's a certain way of thought, or I'll call it an intuition, will drop into my head, and it's always above my left ear. I don't know why. But when my thought hits that spot above my left ear, I stop what I'm doing, and I go take action. Because I don't know if that's divine intervention. I don't know if that's an angel or a guide saying, Denise, would you just pay attention? Whatever it is, I listen. Have you found that to be true in your life, that you get certain sparks of imagery or brilliance and you go do something about it? Sounds like you do.
Sometimes it'll happen when I'm laying down. When I first saw the MPV player, I was laying down going to sleep, and I thought about it because I had just finished test drives, and I got up and I started writing it down so I'd remember it in the morning. And then when you do things, you'll have so many people that tell you it won't work. You can't do that. You know, the hardest deal I've ever done, and I've probably the hardest company, and I've done at least a half a dozen of them, has been the MP3 player. You think, oh, it's a natural. It was the hardest thing to raise money. I didn't get one venture capitalist that participated. I got venture capitalists that were owners of the fund or presidents or fund managers that personally wrote checks, but their funds didn't qualify. It was too risky. I raised $8 million at $25,000 at a time. I spent so much of my time just raising money. Then, you know, after we went public, it was a natural, but it wasn't always that way. Entrepreneurs face an uphill battle, and entrepreneurs are usually visionaries to such a degree. Sometimes we're too early. We see visions before the market is ready, and many times the person who comes in and does it second does it better.
Yeah, and I've seen many, many instances of that, and it's happened to me. Yeah, but at least the idea is out there, and then somebody else can take it and run with it and improve on it. But it kind of sucks that it wasn't, you know, you or me. I mean, that's just kind of the nature of doing business. But you're talking about seed capital. So what is, back then and even now, what is the first step when you're seeking seed capital? What do you do? Do you have kind of a path that you follow now that you've done this so many times, or is each instance brand new and you have to kind of wing it as you go?
No, I have a path. Everybody does it differently, and usually you should follow your strengths and weaknesses. Unfortunately, I haven't done that well in the venture community. I've always done well with angel investors or corporations as partners. I had Intel as a partner, Donnelley as a partner. But I've done well with angels. These are wealthy individuals who believe in a vision and want to participate and write checks. I've done extremely well with them. So typically the way I do it, when I have an idea, this is how I've done it over the years. I will form a company, usually a C corporation, issue shares, lay out a structure of I want to sell, let's say, 25 or 30% of the shares at X amount, and I'll value the company at X amount. I first make a list of friends and family. These are people I know close. These are people who've invested with me before and have made money, or possibly people who've invested with me before and lost money but still trust me. And I go after them first. Then I start to recruit people, finders, who have friends that can bring people in. And this grows and grows. And I find once you get investors and followers, they become evangelists, and they bring their friends in. And this list grows. And when I did the MP3 player, I raised $8 million this way, then about $90 million through the institutional or public market. When I did that solar company in 2008, I raised about $5 or $6 million, all through friends and family. I recommend friends and family to all young entrepreneurs because these are people that should trust you the most, and these are people who can speak with the easiest.
Well, that makes sense. So then the next step would be finding a manufacturer to make your product, and I know You've got some pretty interesting stories around that as well. You're trading private stock for goods and services, how to preserve cash. And we've got about six more minutes, so do you have time to kind of tackle that subject?
Well, I'm a big believer in preserving cash. And there's a saying that cash is king, and that's totally true when you're a startup because you rarely have enough cash. I can't think of a time that I've ever rented a building and not gotten free rent for the first 6 months or a year. And most of the time, I got my landlord to eventually even write a check and purchase stock because he or she became a believer. I look for corporate partners. You know, when I did the MP3 player, I had a corporate partner, Kia, out of Korea, which is Kia, the car company. And they manufactured my MP3 players. So they invested money into my company to get the manufacturing rights for the MP3 player. So wherever you can find someone where there's a mutual benefit, whether it's you're a landlord and you don't have to use cash, or someone that will take stock instead of cash and preserve your cash. This always becomes, as you become more successful, these partners are following your business, and you can also get them to participate in future offerings. This has been a very successful model for me, and I've worked with some of the leading companies in our industry, including Apple, America Online, Creative Labs, and many others over the years.
AOL, are they still around? They still exist, don't they?
Who's that?
America Online, AOL.
Oh, yeah, they're still around. I actually still have an account. They were my first email address, and I still have it, although I currently use a Gmail account. But,
I
sign up for things, I still use the AOL account. I can still remember getting all the CDs in the mail.
Oh, gosh, you and me both. You know, I finally started spray painting them, making decorations out of them for a Christmas tree. They drove me crazy. Every time I went to the post office, there was another 10 or 20 of them, it seemed like. They were ubiquitous. You couldn't get rid of them. But, yeah, they're still around. I mean, they're a very different company than they used to be, but they're still hanging in there, which I think is great. So we are running a bit.
If you go to my website, NathanSchulhoff.com, you'll go to the video section. You'll find a lot of these historical videos that are on there, from the Wango Tango event to some of the AOL stuff. Interesting stuff if you like historical, technical stuff.
I watch some of them. They're fascinating. So exit strategy. So once you've got, and we've got a few more minutes, so once you've gone as far as you want to go with this business, or there's so many reasons why you would want to exit a business, what is the best exit strategy you find?
The exit strategies are very, very important to me, because at the end of the day, I like to take the money. And there's two main ones that I find: sell your company or take it public. I prefer always selling my company, because it keeps the regulators out, and it's more of a sure thing. And you're dealing with one individual or with one company and a board of directors. When I sold my company to Donnelley, our Donnelley and Sons, it was a very, very difficult deal. But it was easier than going public and safer. When you go public, your deal can be canceled on the last day. You're also dealing with regulators such as the Securities Exchange Commission, or you need approval all along the way. You have liability. You have going public expenses that are ongoing and never stops. You also have disclosure items that you're under duty to disclose, and as a private company, you're not. You can keep your secrets hidden. So I've always preferred an acquisition over going public. And I've done acquisitions, as I said, with R. Donnelly and Sons. I've done one with software maker Bloaterbund, and several other companies. Also purchased companies through acquisitions. And I've done 3 or 4 public offerings. I'll do either, which whatever is best for my shareholders at the time.
Now that makes perfect sense. Listen, I've been reading excerpts from your book. So the book for our audience is called Father of the MP3er. Let me try this one more time. I may need coffee. Father of the MP3 Player, Lessons in Business and Life. Nathan, where can people find that book?
You can find it on Amazon. Just go to search for Nathan Schulhoff under search, or Father of the MP3 Player, or Barnes & Noble, or some bookstores.
Great. Okay, we're going to do this again next week, and I'm really excited about that. So where can people find you on the web between now and then?
Well, you can Google my name, Nathan Schulhoff, or go to my website, NathanSchulhoff.com. My email is NathanSchulhoff@gmail.com. And if you email me, I would be glad to send you an interesting chapter on my book.
Oh, thank you. Nathan, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I thank you for all of the wonderful stories and the tips and advice that you've shared with our audience. And I'm very much looking forward to welcoming you, I can't talk today, back to the program next week. And before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Nathan, I'll talk with you again soon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on Your Partner in Success Radio.